Okay, Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee will come to order, please. And we have some delays in some of the bills. This is a tough session for amendments and fiscals and
FizRiz.
That's FizRiz.
It's a great term.
Raise your hand if you know what FizRiz means. Nobody knows what FizRiz means. That was coined by our... go ahead and tell us what that means.
Fiscal impact statement and revenue impact statement.
Yeah, FizRiz. Simple. Yeah. So make note of that, and you'll be cool if you use that.
Oh, good. Another acronym.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 340.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 Amendment, Senate Bill 340.
Oh,
I should let Jennifer...
Oh, yeah.
What we're doing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 340 was originally heard on February 25th, and it provided $5 million general fund dollars to the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities through DHS for Oregon Project Independence. We do, subsequent to that meeting, we have received Dash 1 amendments, and which increased the amount of the funding for OPI from $5 million to $12.6 million.
It's a great amendment, Mr. Chair.
That's a great amendment. Right. Okay.
Motion's on the table.
Motion's on the table. Senator Cruz moves Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 340. Discussion?
Yes. I wish we could put more money into it, but once it gets down to Ways and Means, they could decrease the amount of money.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, and I agree, and it will be their decision how much they fund it for, but this is an ongoing program. It's an incredibly valuable program, and I think it's appropriate for us to send it down there with an appropriate funding level and for their decision. So.
And it's unfortunate, Mr. Chair, that the funding mechanism that we set up last time has fallen through, and I think that's why this fiscal is so huge, because we did have a good mechanism, and then when the economy went bad, that funding mechanism turned out to be not as lucrative as we thought it would be.
Well, as one who carried that bill last time to establish that alternative funding mechanism, was always meant to be a supplement to the general fund and not a replacement. That's been a point of contention with some of the Ways and Means people. Are we ready? Okay. Would you call the roll, please, on this amendment?
Senator Mona Sanders.
Aye.
Senator Bridger.
Aye.
Senator Telfer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair
Morrison. Aye. Okay, the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 340 have been passed. We're going to close the work session.
Because we don't have the FizRiz, so
we don't have the FizRiz. Okay, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 355. Would you tell us about Senate Bill? This is a work session on 355.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 355 has had three previous hearings on February 9th, February 11th, and March 11th. It requires the State Board of Pharmacy to establish and maintain an electronic database to collect and centrally store pharmacy records for controlled substances, Schedules 2, 3, and 4, that are dispensed throughout the state. It specifies conditions under which the board can disclose data to the individuals, researchers, certified practitioners, and pharmacists, law enforcement agencies, health professional regulatory boards, and other state reporting programs. And it asserts that providers are not required to utilize the information in database when making prescribing decisions. It also creates the Prescription Monitoring Program Advisory Commission to provide guidance to board and establish membership and roles of the commission.
Okay. Thank you. Unfortunately, we cannot move this bill today, but Karen Wheeler, would you come up, please? We have some additional information about it, and we should have the amendment that we need hopefully by the next time we meet on Monday, and we're just going to carry this over to have the work session. Karen, would you introduce yourself, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addiction Program Administrator for the Department of Human Services, Addictions and Mental Health Division. Since the last time I was here, I testified on this bill during one of the hearings. The federal government has appropriated funds to what's called the NASPER, or the National All Schedule Prescription Electronic Record System. And what that means is, under Public Law 109-60, the clock begins ticking when that particular act is appropriated funds, so that all competitive grants that are administered by the Health and Human Services, the federal agency, and those grants would relate to drug abuse, so they'd likely be administered by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Grants which states are only eligible to apply for, which would be likely us, AMH, at the Department of Human Services, would be less competitive. Our applications would be less competitive if we do not have a prescription drug program, monitoring program. So the clock began ticking when President Obama signed the omnibus appropriations, or signed the act that appropriated funds to this particular act. So 3 years from the date of his signature is when this will go into effect. So the clock is ticking. They give states 3 years to states that don't have a program like this to develop one, or try to develop one, so that you're more competitive on these grants. So for Oregon, we have, over the last 5 years, I just looked at the grants that we had applied for, which would be subject to this type of preference language, and they total to over $3 million per year. There are no new announcements right now on the SAMHSA website for these particular kind of grants, but we anticipate that they'll be coming out over the next 12 to 18 months under the new administration as they get their programs going. So a lot of the grants are eligible for nonprofits, private entities, and local governments. However, when the grants are only eligible to states, that those grants are usually larger in money. Mm-hmm. So they're $3 to $5 and even up to $7 million a year to specifically combat drug abuse. So I just thought it was important to bring that to your attention.
Good. Good. Thank you, Karen. Questions?
And Mr. Chair, I think it's real important, especially since the governor's budget is just appalling in how it addresses treatment. And so anything that we can take advantage of in helping maintain the infrastructure, too, would these be able to help us in what we're already doing also?
Chair Morissette, members
of these grants?
Yes, these grants relate to treatment, by and large, and also prevention, substance abuse prevention.
Thank you.
This is on 735.
Oh. Okay. Thank you very much, Karen. Thank you. Is this for the next bill that we're going to hear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're waiting on the Dash 5 amendment, which is going to bring a lot of clarity to the funding mechanism for the program, and I think it's an appropriate amendment. So,
yeah. And we do have the fiscal from but there were a couple of problems with clarity that need to be cleared up before we move the bill. So that will be carried over. 355 will be carried over until Monday, and hopefully we'll be able to move it then. So with that, we'll close the public the work session on 355 and open a public hearing work session on Senate Bill 735. Greg, would you come up, please? Senator, or Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Morissette. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the pleasure of representing District 57, which includes some of the most rural and frontier areas of the state in Wallowa, Union, Umatilla, and Morrow counties. Let me begin by sharing with you my admiration for your knowledge and experience as it relates to the complicated issues within the Oregon prescription drug program. I just want to share right up front with you, I under no pretense pretend to understand the complexities of the issues you're having to deal with as it relates to health care in the state of Oregon. And so I do have complete admiration, a level of respect, and to be quite bold with you, a level of trust in the work that you're doing. I also want to share with you right up front how much I appreciate Dr. Goldberg and the assistance he has provided myself in terms of technical assistance, and also a special thank you to Dr. Janine Smith for the wonderful, wonderful technical assistance she has provided me. Mr. Chair, what I'm here to do today is to share my thoughts in favor of Senate Bill 735, especially as it relates to some proposed amendments that I understand will be forthcoming, particularly as it relates to allowing the administrator of the program to establish different program prices for pharmacies in rural areas in order to help maintain statewide access. Right now, in the most rural parts of the state, we have a handful of small little pharmacists who are having a difficult time participating in the Oregon Prescription Drug Program simply because they do not have the volume needed to cover their fixed costs as it relates to the program. And over the last summer, I've had a handful of rural pharmacists come to me who say they want to participate. They want to be good participants with the state of Oregon, good partners with the state of Oregon. They're simply losing money in the program. They're not looking to necessarily profit, but they would like to at least be able to negotiate with the state a rate that covers their costs. Senate Bill 735, as it's being proposed, along with the proposed amendments, allows that opportunity for your rural pharmacist to negotiate. Provides no guarantee, but it at least opens up that door for the negotiation. I just want to share just a very quick story with you. In the last session, this body, including myself, voted to include our teachers as part of the OEBB, Oregon Employment Benefit Board, and I voted for that because I thought it was a good, smart move for the state of Oregon. Our local teachers began to participate in that program, only to find out the rural pharmacist, who has a heart of gold, simply could not provide coverage for that program. They simply couldn't do it because they were losing money. And the next thing you know, very, very good teachers in Morrow County said, we can't participate with our local pharmacists, and they found themselves having to commute upwards of 55 to 60 miles to the next closest pharmacist in Hermiston. Senate Bill 735 rectifies that situation and allows for your most rural and remote pharmacists to at least be able to negotiate. So, Mr. Chair, I definitely appreciate Senate Bill 735. I appreciate the good work that you're bringing forward on this. I appreciate the good work of Dr. Goldberg and Janine Smith, and I just wanted to lend my voice of support.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Thanks.
Thanks, Greg.
Okay, now do you want to talk about 755?
730?
730. Mm-hmm. 735. And who's going to, Dr. Smith and Missy Dolan, would you come up, please? Did you want to?
We just got the,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 735 modifies provisions for administrator to perform any of the functions of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, including but not limited to contracting. And as was just mentioned, we received, and they were at your dais, -1 and -2 amendments that we just received relative to this bill.
Okay.
No, we didn't.
Oh, you should have the dash.
I don't have no amendments.
Really?
Not on this one. I forgot.
You don't have copies made for you.
No, here are the dash ones.
We'll go have copies. Okay.
Well, the dash twos were just handed to us this morning, so we didn't just have the single copies. But the dash twos, I'm sorry, the dash twos were handed, the dash ones. Okay.
Chairman?
I'm sorry. Senator, Representative Greenlick just came in, and I know he's on a very tight schedule. But why don't you just stay there, and he'll come up here when he's through getting instructions from his assistant. Yes, yes. We're always ready for you, Mr. Greenlick. Representative Greenlick.
No.
The godfather.
Godfather.
Of this bill.
The co-godfather.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I was testifying on a bill to make tobacco products a prescription-only drug.
That's interesting.
In the other committee. I hope that will come here when it gets out of that committee and passes the floor of the House. I'm here.
Introduce himself.
Yeah. Did I introduce him? I'm Mitch Greenlick, state representative from House District 33, Northwest Portland and historic Tualatin County. And I'm here to support Senate Bill 735. The chair and I have been working on this project since 2003. Vice Chair was actively involved in the original formation of it. And it now seems we're at a place where we can get to the Oregon Prescription Drug Program where we hoped it would be from the very beginning. I think the issues we're dealing with here in the testimony that have you already heard or will hear soon?
We'll
hear soon, I think, perfects the bill. I think it's already done some amazing things to help people deal with the problem of the unaffordability of prescription drugs, and I think we can move it further and deal with a few other problems like helping rural health care at the same time. I hear Representative Smith has already testified here. I saw him on the way out, and I certainly support the sort of things he's talking about, and I'm definitely here to support these folks in their testimony. So if I can just hang in, and I'll be available to answer questions.
Good. Thank you.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, I'm Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, where the Oregon Prescription Drug Program is housed. I was going to have Missy Dolan, the program's administrator, review the program for some of you who may not be as familiar with it as Senator Morissette and Representative Greenlick, and then we'll run through what the changes this bill brings to the program.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Missy Dolan. I'm the administrator, of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, or as we affectionately call it, OPDP.
Such a clever nickname, huh?
OPDP was authorized under Senate Bill 875 largely due to the efforts of Senator Morissette and Representative Greenlick. It was launched in March of 2005, and at this time, it has been expanded three times since then through ballot measure, through Senate Bill 362, and also through a consortium that was formed with the state of Washington. We currently have about 120,000 individual discount members. We also have about 120,000 group members. On the discount side of the program, any resident in Oregon can come into the program at no cost and receive discounts up to 45% on purchase of their prescription drugs. On the group side of the program, any group that offers their employees medical benefits can bring their prescription drug coverage into the program. And currently, like I said, we've got 120,000 enrollees under the group programs, including the Oregon Educator Benefit Board and SAFE's workers' comp groups. In addition to that, we have 640 participating pharmacies in the state of Oregon and about 25,000 participating pharmacies across the nation. Within those 640 pharmacies, we have 17 of the 20 critical access pharmacies in the state of Oregon participating in the program. The average discount that members receive is about 44% off of their off of the bill charges. And unless there are any questions, I will turn the mic over to Dr. Smith.
Yes. Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Why don't you negotiate with rural pharmacies now? The law allows that.
Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, the reason that I don't negotiate individually with pharmacies is that if I negotiated with one pharmacy, I would need to negotiate with many pharmacies. OPDP has a staff of three, and we don't have actuarial expertise, so that we can't guarantee the outcome of the rates when we change rates. And all of our contracts, all of our group contracts, our master contract with ODS, and our interstate contract have got rate guarantees in them. So the rates that are in Oregon are one rate for all pharmacies. If we had access to PBM for negotiations, the PBMs can negotiate individually with 640 pharmacies, and they do have to negotiate individually with major chains like Walgreens or Walmart, Rite Aid. I don't have the expertise to be able to do that and know what the outcome is going to be, so it would make it impossible for me to go to OEB and say, I'll guarantee you these rates for the term of your contract.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee.
Senator Kelfer.
Thanks. A question. How does this program fit with the Medicaid under federal rebate processes?
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, currently there's a Chinese wall between the OPDP and the Medicaid program, so there's no interaction at all.
Oh, okay.
But this... Excuse me, Representative Greenlee. Yeah. This bill and its amendments, and you'll hear about it from Dr. Smith, facilitates that interaction.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, again, Janine Smith, Office of Health Policy. As you've heard from Ms. Dolan, the prescription drug program has steadily grown its purchasing pool, both public and private groups, and as a means of offering lower-priced prescription drugs for its enrollees, serving over 100,000 uninsured Oregonians as a means of getting access to medications through discounted prices. The aim of 735 and its amendments is to maximize the effectiveness of the program, and it does basically two things. One is to allow the program to use what's called a pharmacy benefit manager or any other service provider to manage the pharmacy network and the other activities of the program. And two, maximize the ability and break down any barriers that are preventing us from working with other state purchasing groups in order to make sure that all doors are open to increase the value brought to Oregonians. This is keeping with the direction of the Oregon Health Fund Board and its work under the Delivery Committee. They focused on the next best steps towards system transformation of our healthcare delivery system, and unifying state purchasing power and cost containment are two important aspects of their recommendations. So regarding the use of a pharmacy benefit manager, what this is where you partner with a vendor. Right now we partner with a vendor to get the claims paid, but the state has to hold the contracts with the network the way the current statute reads. So these amendments change that so that we can use, as our Washington state partners do, that same vendor to actually negotiate and contract with pharmacies to maintain the statewide access. We have, as Missy said, we have over 600 participating Oregon pharmacies, but there's about 26,000 other out-of-state pharmacies because some of these groups have retirees in other states. And so although many of these are chains, there's still at least 100 independent pharmacies. So that's a lot of pharmacy contracts for a three-person staff to manage. Using this, the PBM just allows us to have an overall effective rate, but can allow for individual negotiations. And while it doesn't guarantee a higher rate to any one particular pharmacy, it makes the process of contracting with pharmacies to be more similar to what is done in other commercial plans. Yet it can still be structured as it is in Washington State to be as transparent as possible, which is one of the goals of this program, is that everyone knows what everyone is paying and everything is out and transparent. This could be implemented smoothly. It doesn't incur a significant new cost to the state. It just allows us to broaden our partner, our contract arrangements. As regarding the maximizing the ability to work with state purchasers, 735 and its and the Dash 1 amendments strive to remove further barriers that would allow the program to maximize the ability to work with all state purchasers of pharmacy benefits to determine if there are further opportunities to gain better value. Some partnerships may provide enhanced savings for those groups, and some may not, but the language changes expand the number of doors that can be opened to be explored. The Oregon Health Fund Board recommended unifying state purchasing power as much as possible unless a group can demonstrate greater savings through alternative arrangements. By banding together to increase the size of the group, participants carry more negotiating clout. Coupling negotiating power with evidence-based benefit design is a key to containing costs in the healthcare system. One of the doors OPDP may want to pursue in this language and the amendment allows is to look at strategic or group purchasing arrangements. This would allow the program to work with retail private sector pharmacies to deliver discounted drugs to those groups eligible under a federal act, the Nonprofit Institution Act, to participate in these group purchasing arrangements. By bringing manufacturers' discounts to eligible groups, this new strategic initiative will ease the burden of discounting drugs off the backs of the pharmacies, which was the vision proposed originally by Senator Morissette and Representative Greenlick. We don't believe that Senate Bill 735 or the Dash 1 amendments will have a fiscal impact on the program, but ideally brings enhanced savings in purchasing pharmacy benefits by groups, streamline administrative processes, and continue to allow us to maintain the discount card program for the uninsured.
Mr. Chair, if I can make one final comment. It's often suggested that we as a state act in a more business-like way, and that we follow the sort of market principles. And the underlying concept of the OPDP that you and I brought from the beginning is to use the market to benefit the state and folks involved purchasing power for the state. We have not been able to behave in the same way that, let's say, Kaiser Permanente is able to behave, where I spent much of my life purchasing for 400,000 people in this state, or other large private groups have been able to do. This gives us the ability to concentrate purchasing power and to use market forces to reduce the cost of drugs to us. We heard from the very beginning from the pharmaceutical companies that supported this, and there were several that supported it in the beginning, that if we move market share in a particular direction, our consumers can benefit from that movement of that market share by getting specific discounts for specific drugs. And the use of a pharmacy benefit manager allows us to create a formulary that can do precisely that can bring market benefits to a state activity. And it seems to me it fits perfectly into that concept. And what we're trying to do here is to perfect the process in a way that can allow us to bring to bear those market forces in the benefit of a state activity.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Morris Anderson.
Either Dr. Smith or Ms. Dolan. When we start hiring PBMs, to me it seems like we're forming sort of another industry, so we're adding PBMs that in the long run can increase cost to healthcare systems because we're going to have these PBMs running the show. So what effect would this have, meaning they'd get probably a fee over what they're negotiating, what effect will this have on the commercial payers then and the cost of healthcare in the long run?
Chair Morissette and Senator Monis Anderson, that's a very good question. However, what's going on right now is OPDP contracts with the ODS companies, and the administration of the pricing and the claims payment is done by a pharmacy benefit manager. However, the contract is held with ODS. The only thing that would change under Senate Bill 735 is that OPDP would no longer have to hold the pharmacy contracts with the pharmacies themselves. The PBM that ODS is using already has contracts, and they would try and replicate the current network that we have by going and negotiating with pharmacies that currently are on our network but not on theirs. And they would also try and replicate the effective rate that we're delivering to our groups. However, the payment they're receiving would not be changed. That's under contract. It wouldn't be changed until renewal. They would effectively take over the contracting because that's their primary duty in most arrangements like this. they actually manage the networks. And actually, in our contract with ODS, they have all the responsibilities for auditing. The only responsibility they don't have is to actually hold the contract and set the rates. And so that's the only thing that they would take over. And they have not said that there would be any additional cost for that.
Thank you. Other comments, questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to... I'm sorry. Janine, did you, or Missy, did you talk about the Dash 2s specifically?
Chair Morissette, unfortunately, I've only seen the Dash 1s. I have not seen
I'm sorry, the Dash 1s. You did go over the Dash 1s. Yeah, okay. We do have Dash 2s, and we will ask Jim Gardner to explain what his version is, and then you can respond to that. I think you're going to get a copy of the Dash 2s. Okay. Rick Bennett, would you come up, please? And then Jim Gardner and John Powell. Jim is somewhere. There he is. And John, would you...
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any names. We're neutral on the bill.
Oh, okay. Well, your name was on the...
Yeah. We haven't seen the amendment.
Okay. Go ahead and sit down. Rick, would you like to...
This is the second time in a few days that Jim and I have been up here together like this.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we usually have a different point of view.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for ARP. We've already had the panel of experts on this bill. I just wanted to indicate ARP support for it. As you well know, ARP has supported, both through legislation and ballot measure, the creation and gradual expansion of the program. We have also been very active in efforts, in outreach efforts in support of the program. I believe Senate Bill 735 and the Dash 1 amendments, I have not seen a Dash 2, but we support them and hope that you will move this bill forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you want to talk about Measure 44 and the role that AARP played?
No.
You don't want to talk about it?
Yeah.
You want me to talk about it?
You can talk
about okay.
it. Okay. we certainly appreciate the fact that, Mr. Chairman, that you brought that initiative petition forward. We very much appreciate the opportunity to participate and support that effort with you. Mm-hmm. And obviously the outcome was what we were looking for. So.
Okay. Thank you. AARP did step forward and become a chief co-sponsor of what used to be Ballot Measure 22, and it was not then Ballot Measure 44 after they signed on to it, and played a major, major role in collecting 129,000 signatures, and it passed by 80%. There were no negative comments in the voter's pamphlet. There were over 20 positive comments, and what that did was open this program to the uninsured in the state of Oregon, which is huge. And so without the assistance of the 800-pound gorilla in the room that AARP is, and without AARP's work, it would not have happened. It would not have happened. I introduced that. There's no way I could go out and gather 129,000 signatures. And so now there were some other players in that. SEIU was a player. They also helped to gather and spent some money and so on. But it was a huge, huge effort. And so... thanks to AARP.
And I would also mention we certainly appreciated the neutral position taken by Mr. Gardner and his clients as well. It was greatly appreciated.
Yes, and I assume that he is continuing his neutrality and is going to enlighten us about his Dash 2 amendments. So thank you.
Thank you.
Rick.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I represent Pharma. And I am happy and proud to say that we do have some claim to parentage for the original version of the bulk purchasing program. We had the opportunity to work with yourself, Senator Cruz, and a number of other legislators when we fashioned that. And the just to sort of for a little bit of history, the original intent was really to focus on essentially state entities that might benefit from aggregating demand, and also low-income people who were lacking coverage. As AARP graciously noted, we did not oppose your ballot measure to expand, and we followed with great interest the continuing deliberations. One of the proposals that we had originally, which I think may come to fruition, was that the participation of PEB ought to be either encouraged or mandated, because that was the sort of on the state side the biggest kind of gorilla in the room. Likewise, OEB with the new creation of that entity. Part company, and I'm honestly not sure to the degree that this is a cosmetic difference or is actually a real policy difference, is on two fronts with regard to this bill. The Dash 2 amendments address one of those and basically say that the one thing we probably should not do is bring Medicaid into this program. And the reason is, as pretty clearly indicated in that February 14, 2003 letter from CMS to the state of Michigan, it has been federal law and federal policy for some time that you can't use the Medicaid lives essentially as a leverage point in conjunction with a kind of PBM function, a prior authorization function. You can't use those as leverage to attempt to drive down prices in non-Medicaid programs. And that's, there have been, 11 or 12 states that have tried that, and they've all met with no success from CMS. Now, obviously, that could change. We don't think it will. And so the Dash 2 amendments simply restore the historic prohibition on inclusion of Medicaid in the prescription drug program. Medicaid, I should say, already benefits from a best price law that the feds enacted, and that basically they use their clout, not simply the clout of the state of Oregon, but their clout to ensure that Medicaid does receive best price. So we think this, if you were to actually, it does say may. I will concede that the language in Senate Bill 735 with regard to Medicaid does say may. But if you were to actually attempt to bring Medicaid into the program, I think you'd run into, based on what other states have experienced, an insurmountable barrier at the federal level. So, our best advice is, work on the program, expand it, particularly with PEB and OEB, but probably not go the Medicaid route. The other change, which is not covered in the Dash 2s, but I just want to address because it came up in terms of Senator Cruz's discussion about rural pharmacies. I think that as Senator Cruz indicates, there is existing authority, but if you really wanted to make that work, I'd suggest on the rural pharmacy negotiation piece, you say shall rather than may. That's my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Janine, Missy. Thanks, Jim.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, we just got handed the Dash 2 amendments, and basically it is, as Mr. Gardner suggests, that they're trying, that the essence of 735 and the Dash 1s was to remove all barriers and allow us to at least explore options with groups, including Medicaid. We understand that Michigan did apply for a state plan amendment in 2003. That was a different administration. We do know that Maine has taken cases all the way to the Supreme Court to show that there is no prohibition against it from a from a court perspective to partner with Medicaid. I think what we would need to do is look and see what is doable and what isn't with Medicaid. We don't certainly want to break any federal rules and regs. We know that any that there's very specific CMS rules. Our office has oversight over the Medicaid program, and we work very closely with the Medicaid program. So I think it's really just that in 735 we want to just open all the doors, that there isn't any one group that we couldn't do partnering with, but that we need to explore it and see what would be beneficial. There may be that bringing the Medicaid group in doesn't necessarily help Medicaid or doesn't necessarily help OPDP, but at least it would allow us an opportunity to look at it. And we don't know whether a different type of state plan amendment request would be approved on a federal level. So I think there is the potential would be just allowing the doors to be open to look and not pass up on any opportunity that could be available now or could be available in the future. And the also 735 has an option to either continue our current ability to have the network developed by us or the PBM, and we need to look at that again, trying to keep as much flexibility in the program to look and see what's the best way to maintain a statewide access and access in communities. So I think that the language in the dash ones and the original 735 allow us to have a lot of flexibility about how we develop the pharmacy network and doesn't necessarily restrict us one approach or the other.
Good. Thank you. Yes.
Follow-up question. Just the assurance that so that the intent here is not to utilize Medicaid and its best price, its rebate, to force other drug prices down.
Senator Telfer, the intent is really just to be able to explore what, if any, possibilities there are to either get better pricing with any of the programs. Washington State has its public employees in, and they don't always have the best prices for one group, but it helps overall for all the groups. But Medicaid is very specific in that you want to be sure that you're not using the Medicaid clout to do something that's for someone who's not Medicaid eligible. So it would need to be structured carefully to see if there's this program itself is going to be trying to figure out how to get supplemental rebates through some other Medicaid partnering arrangements with other states currently. But we just wanted to be able to open the door to see if there was some way that this could, you know, help either Medicaid or help the group.
Comments?
Mr. Chair, I guess I can't understand how expanding it to Medicaid to add those lives doesn't just inherently say you're using Medicaid as clout to lower prices. I mean, I don't understand how that can't be the result of doing that.
Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, one of the ideas that's been explored by other states is that you are actually, if you can give an additional benefit to non-Medicaid residents to keep them out of the Medicaid program, you're helping the Medicaid program. So if you could keep an asthmatic or a diabetic on their prescription drugs, they may stay employed and they may not end up on the Medicaid rolls. So we would have to demonstrate that is what we'd be using the funds for. So that's just one of the ideas that's been explored. But like Dr. Smith said, we have to look at ways that if we extended any of the benefits to non-Medicaid individuals, it would actually help the Medicaid program. And we would have to demonstrate that to the administration.
A follow-up?
Yes.
Okay, but what you're driving for and why PEP should be included in these others is the more lives you have, the better deals you can cut. I mean, that's the theory behind this. The bigger pool, the better deal you can cut. So I don't understand how including Medicaid program in this, which expands the pool to get a better deal, isn't using Medicaid to cut a deal for a non-Medicaid program.
Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, I think what this bill does is it just allows us to explore the options. I mean, it just doesn't close any doors. And so it doesn't direct us as a, there is other legislation in the House, in the building, that says that, yes, you must partner with Medicaid. This just allows us to possibly do it. It doesn't necessarily say we have to do it, and we would need to be very careful and cautious and thoughtful about how and if it does bring some benefit, but it just doesn't close the door. The current statute prohibits us from even thinking about it. In this case, we know that it's been successfully allowed in Maine. You had some evidence that perhaps they had some troubles in Michigan, but you know, there's a lot of work that could be done to look at it to see if, and still stay within the confines of federal law.
Thank you. First of all, Jim, are you coming up? Okay. I do want to thank Mr. Gardner, Jim Gardner, for his assistance in getting the program going. Tom Holt, who's sitting in the audience, also helped. This was 2003. John Minnis, Senator John Minnis, helped, and we put together a program that included 50 residents, 54 and older, 185% of poverty, and that was a start. But with all complicated programs, it takes time to adjust and to move forward, and this is, you know, we last session we had a bill that included the underinsured, which is interesting. Now, who is underinsured? Well, someone whose regular insurance company doesn't cover a particular drug, then they're underinsured, or someone whose copay is higher than our card would be, the OPDP card, which allows a consumer to use either or. And that takes care of the underinsured. So now, whether it, what I'm a, on the PIB board, the advisory board. I'm an ex officio member, and there was a long discussion held with PIB about whether or not they should come under the program. And I remember when Jane Thorne was the director of PIB, and she made a very simple statement that simply that said, if it's going to cost the state money for PEB to be covered under OPDP, we're not going there. And I agree. And that's true with any public employee group. We can't force them into a program that will cost their jurisdiction more money than they're getting, than they're spending on private insurance, and so on. So PEB is thinking about several options, including self-insurance in a year or two, and they're still thinking about coming under the OPDP if it pencils out. Now, as Mr. Gardner said, he recommended originally that PEB come under and that we require it, but I don't think that would be economically feasible to require them if it costs more money. So what we're working at here is to improve the program now. There's a new, okay, we're talking about various options under the Health Fund Board, and we're talking about different federal regs, including rebates. Not rebates, but match. The federal match is much higher than it was a year ago, and who knows what the federal regulations will do with Medicare, Medicaid, and so on. And what we're doing in this bill is trying to have some options available so we don't have to come back next time and say we shall. We don't want to say we shall. We may. We're going to look at it. And if it's beneficial to the citizens of Oregon to do this, we should do it for the benefit of those people who have to pay the cost of prescriptions. That's what we're doing it for. That's who we're doing it for. So the May opens the doors, and that was largely the intent of this bill, is not to mandate certain things that we are not ready to do at this time but may be ready in the future. And it's interesting, I'm trying to remember the name of the DHS person who left Oregon to go to the state of Maine, took the case to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that Maine had the right to do whatever it is they were doing. And he came from the state of Oregon. He's now in the state of Ohio, I believe. And I, for the life of me, I can't remember his name, but he did fight that battle with the Supreme Court and was successful. So things are in flux, and they will be in the future, and so the purpose of this bill is to give the flexibility. Others wishing to testify? Okay. Now, we don't have... Oh, is there another sheet there?
No, same sheet.
We don't have a fiscal and revenue and all that stuff.
FISRES.
We don't have
a FISRES. No, Mr. Chair, we don't.
We don't have the amendment on the amendment.
Yes. Okay, so we will close the public hearing and come back to this again. Okay, next bill. Where are we?
177.
Pardon me?
177.
Okay, are we ready to do this one thing on
177? Yeah,
wake you up. Okay. We're going to open a work session, public hearing, work session on Senate Bill 177. Martin? Do we have his name on the list here?
No, because of the work session.
At long last.
At long last.
Go ahead, Martin.
Good morning, Senator Chair Morissette, Chair Senator Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Martin Pitioni. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Clinical Social Workers.
Martin, I just have to say this. You are the only one who correctly pronounces my name. Morissette.
Thank you.
Morissette, Chair. And it was wonderful when we were visiting in France. Everybody knew how to pronounce Morissette.
Go ahead. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Shall we start doing that?
Morissette.
Okay.
We need to have him say it a couple more times.
So go ahead.
It's a pleasure. For the record, my name is Martin Pitioni, Executive Director for the Board of Clinical Social Workers, and it's a pleasure to be back before you on behalf of the board on Senate Bill 177. You may recall the bill had a hearing, one hearing before in February, I believe.
January 28th.
Thank you. And we were directed afterwards by the chair to enter into a work group to work out the remaining issues with Senate Bill 177. And you may recall we had testimony not just from the board then, but also from SEIU and DHS as well as NASW on various issues with the bill. I have the pleasure to report back to you this morning. Mission accomplished. We're back. There are two sets of amendments that I think that are really at issue before you today. One are the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 177, and basically, just on a big picture first, those amendments clean up all the issues that were raised by stakeholders at the original hearing on 177. They corrected some drafting errors and problems in the original 177, and that includes explicit civil penalty authority for the board to penalize those who practice after license revocation. We had problems with board makeup language in the bill because there was inadvertent language in there that would have possibly eliminated clinical social workers, set up the potential for not having clinical social workers on the board. That was taken care of. We took care of the specific issue on educational titles. There was some concern that folks who are using educational titles such as Masters of Social Work, that they would somehow be affected by the title protections proposed in Senate Bill 177. There's specific language in here that takes care of that, and the dash ones also on a consensus basis from the work group take care of changing the proposal in 177, which would have increased the civil penalty authority of the board to $5,000 from $1,000, and basically took that down to a $3,000 level. Those are, in a nutshell, the most important cleanups in a dash one. All of those have consensus from the stakeholders involved. One other key
guys. Okay, go. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Huh? You were too loud.
You were too loud.
It's him.
Oh, okay.
He's a loud guy.
Go ahead.
One other key piece that happened in the dash ones is that we also, to really get the consensus of the stakeholders, you may recall that in the original 177, we really proposed basically a wholesale rewrite of practice definitions for the field of social work. And basically, those are gone under the dash ones. And that was key to establishing stakeholder consensus. And the dash ones revert to the definitions that have served the board well on just clinical social work only since 1977. So we have the basic consensus proposal for you on the dash ones, okay. But as part of developing that consensus proposal on the dash ones, we basically also found the formula to go further. You may recall that one of the key questions that we had from the committee when we brought this to you under the compromise bill was, why don't you go further? Because the original bill really, basically all it really did was expand the authority of the board for voluntary non-clinical licensure in the field of social work and did not have a practice act element in it. And basically, the good news is that as part of this work group work, we also found the formula to bring you the dash fours. And the dash fours are really everything that the dash ones do plus an actual practice act which is very focused on clinical social work only with a standard set of exemptions. And the exemptions basically being for those who are already licensed or certified by the state of Oregon to provide mental health services, exemptions for those for clergy, the standard clergy exemption that if you are a member of the clergy and you are acting in your ministerial capacity that you are exempted from this act. And there's also a specific exemption in there that we added into the dash fours for the graduate students in the MSW programs because they have a practicum where they are doing clinical work under supervision, and we had to obviously throw in language to make sure that that could continue. So we're back. We are pleased to report we actually were able to go further than we thought we could get and bring it back to you this session. I may also want to report that you know, since this is an agency bill, we also had a discussion about this bill during our budget sessions in Ways and Means. And in Ways and Means, it was also very clear that we got a lot of support for the board to go further and to go the Practice Act route. So that's one thing I wanted to put on the record. The other thing I quickly want to mention as part of that is the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education also in the end ended up putting in a budget note into our current budget that basically requires this board to go back to the legislature if 177 passes to deal with the fiscal impact, which is relatively small on this board. So we have that budget note already. I don't know what the impact of that action is with respect to, you know, the current subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but I just want to put that on the record for you that that's the action that the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education took with respect to 177. With that, I think I would like to just kind of stop here and open up for questions.
Okay. Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that it addresses the issues from DHS in mental health. Does that include the drug addictions?
We had
Chair
Senator Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson, excellent question. We did have some email traffic on that yesterday as to whether or not that was an issue with DHS, and ultimately DHS concluded that it was not an issue for them. So they are on; they're still on board. And if Patty's in the back of the room, I think she's would be nodding her head by now. So
she's only smiling.
She's only smiling. Cringing.
Okay. She doesn't really nod her head very often.
I'm going to ask Patty to come up.
And then just a follow-up, too. I know that say, a program like Healthy Start with our field nurses whom we're working with migrant populations, and we are going in there, and we sometimes have, they're really paraprofessionals. They are people, I don't think they reach into a social work, but sometimes we send people out like that, and I'm not sure if they would be affected or not. This is a real...
Chair Moniz Anderson, or sorry, Chair Morissette. I don't know how to do it in French.
That's okay.
One of my daughters is a French teacher, but for the record, I'm Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the Department of Human Services. This was something that yesterday I coddled together all the amendments and started kind of looking it over in terms of how it affects the bill. And I emailed Martin. Unfortunately, it wasn't April Fool's Day because I mentioned Dash 7s, which there aren't any, and he just got flew out of it.
April Fool's jokes are best on
a different day.
I
was looking at a lot of different bills and a lot of different amendments. So, but at any rate, I brought that issue of our alcohol and drug folks up when I saw the language of the exemptions, and I said, you know, we might need a tweak. How do you want to take care of it? Then Martin said, well, but they're not doing clinical social work. And so I said, that's true. They're not. And so I think that the bill, with all the amendments, as we've worked really hard and Martin's worked really hard over the last couple months, has narrowed it down to truly clinical social work. That's what we're counting on. As you know, the original bill we opposed because they had changed the definition of social work to include just about everything all of our employees do. And so that was a problem with us. They've now narrowed it back down to truly social work. And so the Practices Act piece, it applies only to clinical social workers. Our A&D folks are not clinical social workers by definition of what a clinical social worker is. So I don't feel, and I'm going on, which you shouldn't do in this job, but I'm going on good faith that there is no intention to start looking at people doing their job that is not considered clinical social work. And A&D treatment folks do peer-to-peer, they do counseling, they do treatment, but they're not clinical social workers. And so there was no need in my mind to exempt them, and I would imagine it would be the same with, because we have maternal and child health nurses that go out all over the state to, again, migrant labor camps and all over, and they do some amount of, they don't do treatment, but they do counseling and all those kinds of things out for the people that they run into. Because when you go into situations like that, if you're a trusted person, you do what you can while you're there, and you don't usually send in somebody that's licensed just because they need a helping hand. So you do what you can while you're there. So I'm fine with the bill. I just want to say on record that I don't believe it's the intention of the board to go out with a sweeping arm and bring in any of our employees that aren't truly clinical social workers, which we do have some at the state hospital, and they are licensed, and we require them to be licensed. And if they lost their license, they would no longer be employed by us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mara Roach, would you like to come up and give us your assurances that we're okay?
I was going to see if I could do this all in French.
Oh. That's okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Maura Roach, National Association of Social Workers. We have worked with Martin and Patty to come to agreement on these amendments. We had, I think the dash threes were our amendments, which we're not moving forward with at this time. They're still an incorrect aspect to how those were drafted, and so we know that this bill needs to move out of committee, and we're going to take a look at making that adjustment over on the House side, but it's, again, something that we've worked with folks to come to agreement on how to get that structured. We're just struggling a little bit with the language, and we expect to get it resolved.
Okay, good. Well, I really appreciate your hard work and patience on this, and I know it's important to you, so I think that's a good idea to do it on the House side, because we do have to move these bills. So.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
What about the dash fours?
Well, they're all-encompassing, I believe.
Are they? Okay.
Four includes one.
Mm-hmm. Four includes, okay, so we keep, gotcha.
And there are no sevens. Or fives or sixes.
That's going to happen on the House. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the minimal impact, what does that mean?
Less than 50.
Correct.
Well, okay. The rules on ways and means referrals are kind of slippery and slidey, but a minimal impact, I guess, is supposed to mean it's less than $50,000, and that's the fiscal, right?
Correct.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chair,
do we have a revenue?
Were we given instructions that if they have a minimal, they still go to ways and means?
No.
That, I mean, that's what I was instructed, so we need to clarify that. So I sent a couple of bills to ways and means that were minimal impact.
Mr. Chair, I actually had a conversation with the President's office regarding this yesterday, and I'm waiting to hear back from Phil, because I, too, had that question about why this would be going to Ways and Means, and requested that they lift the subsequent, especially given that Martin testified that on his budget bill, he's also got a budget note regarding this, and I don't know if we need both belt and suspenders moving this forward. So I do have that request in, but I don't know the status
okay. Well,
of it yet.
Well, we better wait then, I guess.
No, you know, or we could pass it and request the subsequent referral be removed, and then it's in the President's court, as
right.
He can either send it down or send it to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so,
good idea.
Yep.
I think the President sent the precedent one time in your committee when
yes,
we did. He did move his bill to the floor.
Yeah, actually a fair amount of money.
Yeah. And I commented at the time for the record that is a precedent that you're setting, Mr. President.
I don't think he picked up on that.
No, I don't think he did. But we'll remind him. I think I have that tape, so we can replay that. Okay, thank you very much. And we will close the public hearing and open a work session. Now, we're going to pass the fours, and we'll rescind, or do we just...
We'll pass the fours, and then we'll move the bill as we're supposed to move it, and request the subsequent referral be rescinded.
Okay.
So, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash four amendment to Senate Bill 177.
Okay. Now, just a clarification, the dash fours will automatically take the place of
one amendment. Work session. He closed public hearing, open work session.
They're the same, and they'll just simply replace the others automatically. Okay, so Senator Cruz moves the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 177. Discussion, objection, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 177 as amended by the dash four amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and request a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves 177 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, and requests that the Ways and Means referral be rescinded. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I just really appreciate the fact that we're moving to a practice act. I think that's such a better way to do business.
Okay, that's good. Other discussion? Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator
Telford?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morrison?
Aye. Okay. Senate Bill 177 goes to the floor, we hope, with a due pass recommendation. And who would like to... Oh, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. Because it does include some of the people that you...
Just go.
Yes. Yeah, here's go. Okay. Good. Okay. So Senator Mona Sanderson will carry the bill. And with that, we will close the public hearing, our work session, and we are adjourned.